This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Statistics on gangs are notoriously difficult to nail down, but every measure available suggests that gang violence, gang activity, and gang membership are all up across the country. Some gangs have expanded from distinctly local roots to become regional, national, and in a few cases, international organizations. Theories about why include globalization, the internet, and the unexpected consequences of American immigration policies. Here in Washington today, there's a conference that focuses on gangs in the U.S. and Central America. We'll talk with a participant at that conference later in the program. One item of concern is homicide rates. While homicides and crime in general are down nationwide, the number of street gang killings is rising, up more than 50% between 1999 and 2002, according to one nationwide study. Later in the program, the Supreme Court and racial segregation in California prisons, plus the long effort to identify victims of 9/11, winds up in New York City. But first, gangsters without borders. What's happening where you live? Have you seen changes in gang activity or gang culture? If you're familiar with street gangs as a teacher, counselor, police officer, or prosecutor, give us a call, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. We also welcome email. The address is totn@npr.org. And we begin with somebody who knows this problem firsthand. Ricky Smith is a detective with the Hempstead Police Department in Hempstead, New York, a member of a Long Island Law Enforcement Task Force on gangs, and he joins us from police headquarters. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much.
Long Island is not exactly the first place most people connect with Latin American gangs.
No, tell you the truth, it really ain't. But over the last 10 to 15 years, we've had a large influx of Central Americans onto Long Island. And it definitely has raised the gang problem.
Tell us a little bit about what I understand is the primary gang there, MS-13. First of all, what does that stand for?
MS-13 stands for Mara Salvatrucha. It's a Salvadorian and L.A.-based gang. Like I said, the influx of Central Americans in the late 80s, early 90s, came into areas like Long Island, Virginia, and L.A., and unfortunately also brought the problem of these Latin American gangs.
I assume the organization has grown and changed over time.
Yes. Originally, when we first started to see them, they wasn't really that organized, very loosely knit. But over the years now, we're starting to see definitely a growth of organization within the gang, and they are now communicating with each other in out of states into the other areas like Virginia, California, and also back down to even El Salvador.
Mm-hmm. What kinds of activities are they involved in?
We see them predominantly involved on Long Island, really with street robberies, street assaults, homicides, drive-by shootings, some extortion.
And is this within their community, or are there victims outside the Latino community?
Tell you the truth, most of their victims are within the Latino community. And most of the, like you said, the arch rivalry they have is with any other street gang. They do not get along with any other type of street gang, say the Bloods, the Crips, the Latin Kings. They have a... no kind of a commitment to any of those type of gangs, and their belief is either you're with us or you're against us.
Those other gangs you mentioned, they're active on Long Island as well?
We do see members of those also being active on Long Island, yes.
At what point does what these gangs are doing, how is it different from what the traditional organized crime families do?
Well, at least with MS-13, like you said, they're still not that organized, where they have that one leader that calls the shots for everybody. Most of the cliques, which they call cliques or area groups, are run by one person, and he pretty much don't want to give up his authority in his area to that one person to call the shots throughout, like you said, the whole community.
Mm-hmm. And how are you reacting to this department, you and law enforcement there?
We've been very active. Tell you the truth, when we actually saw this problem in Hempstead back in like the early 94, 95, our mayor and our police chief were very good with us. sort of problem. We started up a gang unit. When we saw that we were having definitely a larger influx in that we couldn't really not control but handle at the time, our mayor and police chief went outside to federal agencies and state agencies to form a federal task force. We were lucky enough that the FBI, New York State Police, Nassau County Police, other local police departments like Freeport and Port Washington, mm-hmm. also Nassau County Jail, assigned full-time officers into our task force. And we were able to start doing some really good cases against some of these gangs and their leaders and putting them in jail and charging them federally with federal laws instead of state laws.
As you go about this, I wonder, do you think that law enforcement is, you know, obviously people are doing bad things, committing crimes, they want to be arrested and especially put the ringleaders behind bars. But is law enforcement the answer to this problem?
Well, not really. Well, law enforcement definitely is one of the solutions, but there's also, I do a lot of teaching within the community, also going around to schools and community groups, informing the parents and people that, you know, they have to watch their kids and pay attention to what their kids are doing. And also, you know, to what it has to be a community, it's a community problem, there's no doubt. The administrators of the village have to be involved, the school districts have to be involved, the churches have to be involved, and community leaders all have to be involved. Hopefully, you know, we have to give these kids something else to do, too. A lot of these kids that do join these gangs are drawn into these gangs because they have, you know, either economical problems, home problems, or they're having problems in school, and the gangs actually draw them in and say, you know, we'll take care of you, we'll be part of you, but once they get in, sometimes it's too late because they get involved with criminal activity, mm-hmm. and, you know, once they get involved with that, then it's our problem. So, like you said, us in the police world, we try to get out there. You know, we want to inform everybody that, you know, everybody has to be involved and hopefully, you know, to try and control this problem.
Yeah. Would you say that this is getting better or getting worse?
Well, us here on Long Island, I'd say since we've been pretty active lately, you know, with this initiative and that, I've seen it can tell a little bit. But unfortunately, like you said, gangs out in California, they're in their fifth, sixth generation. Unfortunately, here we have kids that are starting to go into the second generation already. So I could say it hasn't grown in Long Island maybe over the last year or so, but it hasn't gotten better either.
Ricky Smith, good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Detective Ricky Smith with the Hempstead Police Department. He joined us from their headquarters in Hempstead, Long Island. Well, with us now from our bureau in Chicago is Andrew Papakristos. He's worked with street gangs for more than 12 years. He's a gangs researcher at the University of Chicago. His article, Gang World, appears in the latest issue of Foreign Policy magazine, and it's good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
We just heard this detective in Long Island saying these Los Angeles-based gangs have expanded to his territory. They're expanding all across the country.
Right. I think one of, as you properly cited, and Detective Smith properly cited, one of the things that we've seen, especially in the 90s, was this proliferation of gangs across the country. And in some regards, what we think internationally, the kind of important thing to remember following on his tale here is that gangs like the MS-13 and the Bloods and the Crips and the Latin Kings, these gangs are anomalies in the gang world. They are the worst that gangs can become and not what, in fact, most gangs are. Now, I say that in Chicago, where we have the most organized and most violent gangs probably in the world. But it's important to put that in context because one of the aspects of gangs that has proliferated, even more so than members from L.A. going to Hempstead, is the proliferation of kind of gang culture, as well as kind of the movement of individual gang members and their family. So we are still seeing that aspect.
When you talk about a more typical gang, what's it like?
Well, first of all, it's real important to kind of get off. You know, one of the things I've learned from hanging out with gang members these past dozen years or so is that the existence of most gang members is absolutely hyper-local. You spend your time, your existence, in a 4 or 5 block radius of your home. Most gangs, even in Chicago, the local kind of sets and chapters of these gangs are loosely organized. The boundaries are kind of vague. They are involved in what criminologists like to call cafeteria-style crime, which is a little bit of this, a little bit of that. In Chicago now, it is the case that gangs are involved in very organized drug dealing, but that's not the case across the country and in other cities, Chicago, L.A., New York. These are exceptions. So most gangs are these kind of small, transitory types of groups.
And in fact, MS-13, which we were talking about, that 13 stands for something very specific.
Right. It stands for a street in California and L.A. The name has references to kind of the El Salvador movements and political struggles. And when you see kind of the exportation of these gang identities, you see gangs now in Spain and calling themselves Latin Kings, and they're mimicking the Chicago and New York Latin Kings, but you know they're so far removed from the origins of these gangs that in some ways it's more just kind of a copycat thing. Now, that's not to say that that's not necessarily dangerous. It could lead to other things. Obviously, there's a need in other cities where you have disenfranchised youth kind of forming gangs or gangs persisting in importance because of these kind of consistent economic and social needs.
Let's see if we can get a caller on the line. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 800-989-8255. Email totn@npr.org. And Dave joins us from San Andreas, California.
Hi, good to be here.
Hey, Dave.
One of the things that I've noticed in my experience as a volunteer with the California Youth Authority is over the years, gang members in particular and inmates in general are getting tougher and tougher and care less and less about the crimes they commit and the behavior they have on the inside as well. I think part of what contributes to that is the media. These guys are playing video games and then just going out and doing what they do on the computer, on television.
And movies and television, I suspect, play their part as well?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's my opinion.
Would you agree with that, Andrew?
Well, in terms of getting the first part of the comment, in terms of getting more violent and being involved in these things, I mean, I think that what's really at the root of that is a problem that's a larger problem, which is an ex-offender problem, which is we have people that are going through the system and returning to a community without a lot of social or economic opportunities. And so when the gang is waiting there for you, it's a really nice kind of a welcome home, which you don't see in kind of other areas of the community.
Dave, thanks very much for the call. We're going to continue talking about this and some of the other problems associated with gangsters, including Gangsters Without Borders, when we continue after a short break. 800-989-8255, TOTN at NPR.org. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're discussing the reach of gang culture across the country and increasingly the world. Our guest is Andrew Papakristos. He's worked with and studied street gangs for more than a decade in Chicago. You're invited to join the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And Andrew Papakristos, in your article in Foreign Policy magazine, one of the interesting points you make is how the Internet has helped spread gang culture internationally.
I think the Internet makes the kind of spread. I mean, because gangs, and especially in Chicago and Los Angeles, have become so institutionalized, which is you can recognize their culture, their symbols, their handshakes really around the world, that it becomes very easy to kind of adopt these personalities wherever you might be, whether you're in rural Iowa or in Axe Bay, Spain. It's cool to be a Latin King. It's not so cool to start a new gang kind of called the Papakristos Posse. No one's going to join that. But if you come up with a gang that has a reputation, one that's particularly violent or kind of has appeared in the media, it's definitely more appealing than starting something brand new. It has more reputation.
And even if you describe yourself as a Latin King somewhere else overseas, is anybody going to get up beside you for claiming to be a Latin King?
Well, the funny part about that is if you go on some of these chat rooms and bulletin boards, and these are where the kind of virtual gang warfares are happening now. The nice part about that is nobody gets shot on the Internet. But at the same time, what you see is you see a lot of people claiming to be Latin Kings, and they're using language and things like that. They're often using them incorrectly, which has no bearing, again, on violence in this case, where on the street it would. But you see people kind of trading, you know, remarks back and forth, kind of disrespecting each other, supporting each other, just like you would kind of in on the street corner. But like I said, the nice part about it as a social problem is it hasn't yet led to many Internet shootings.
Let's get another caller on the line. Carolina's with us from Franklin, Massachusetts.
Hi there.
Hi.
I had direct experience with this whole thing. My son was involved in a gang in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts, and it was mostly comprised of kids that were Latino, but there were also some African-American kids and some white kids. So it was unusual in that it was somewhat integrated. And it was usual in that they were protecting their corners and their neighborhoods. And these were kids that had grown up. I had seen them grow up from little, from 3, 4, 5 years old. And as they approached adolescence, that's when the violence started coming in. That's when dressing up like, you know, other guys in the hood started coming in. And sort of what you're talking about, the media thing, sort of taking on that persona. And then when you're in a neighborhood where there is drug dealing and there is violence, you act that stuff out. So my son was involved for about 3 or 4 years. And when he decided to get out, it was really hard because for about 2 years afterwards, they chased him literally through the streets trying to kill him. I myself went to the cops. I met with other ex-gang members in the community, and I think that is what probably saved his life. But I can also say that Jamaica Plain, the part of Boston where we lived at the time, was being yuppified, and they didn't want that bad press, that there were actually gangs there because it would lower real estate. The other thing that I wanted to contribute was that what I noticed is these kids had nothing to do after school. Nothing. Besides going to the local community center and playing pool and playing on the pinball machines, there was nothing to further their education. Boston public schools are pretty crappy. The dropout rate for Latinos is about 50% or 45%. And there was nothing there to catch them, to bring them, to make them part of the culture. A lot of them were from homes that were broken, but not exclusively. A lot of times their parents were just having to work 2 and 3 jobs to pay the high Boston rents. So I think it's an economic piece, as well as a racial thing going on, because a lot of times these kids are separated out according to their racial groups, and they have to sort of hang together to be able to protect each other. So, you know, I think it's a lot more local, like you guys were saying, and it's going to depend on what's going on in the economy in that area. But there's other pieces, too, with kids looking for belonging.
Yeah. Can I ask what gang your son was a member of?
Oh, it was just a small gang. They called themselves the Green Street Boys. And but they used to use all the colors of the Crips and the Bloods and the whole nine yards.
That sound familiar, Andrew?
It does sound very familiar. First of all, I'm glad to hear that your son was able to get out and that he had you around to kind of support them, because obviously, like you're pointing out, there are a lot of instances where gang members don't have that type of support. But, you know, this is in some ways a much more classic pattern of a street gang. And this is Boston we're talking about, not, you know, not the middle of a small town Illinois. The first thing to kind of remember that you're pointing out is that delinquency in general is a group phenomenon. So kids are going to hang out in groups, whether they call them cliques or crews or, you know, in Chicago, they don't call themselves gangs. They call themselves street organizations or nations. So what they become labeled as a gang tends to be a very political issue. You brought up the issue of gentrification. Well, you know, if you're gentrifying a neighborhood, of course you don't want to have, you know, gang members standing on the corner. You try to push them out or you call them something else. In the 90s, this was a big issue. A lot of cities did not want to admit they had gangs, because if you had a gang problem, then all of a sudden it meant like you were like Chicago or L.A. That's what it meant to have a gang problem. Mm-hmm. So those are very familiar. And in terms of how to spend your time, this is a, you know, this is a perpetual problem. I think every generation says this about the next generation. Whether or not these groups that hang out turn into a gang or a basketball team is a very different range of behaviors. And, you know, we want to see more basketball teams and less gangs, I suppose, is the answer. And trying to figure out how to do that is what's the hard part.
Well, I noticed that sometimes the smartest kids would get involved in the gangs. And those were the kids that were sort of administrating or organizing.
Well, they'll be the leaders, absolutely. Gang leaders are real charismatic folks. They have the same qualities it takes to be, you know, a leader elsewhere. In fact, the original Mayor Daley in Chicago was a member of a social athletic club, the Hamburg Boys. So, you know, it wasn't until the 60s and 70s that becoming a gang member was necessarily a problem. It used to be a regular part of boyhood, so to speak, although it's now more increasingly involving women. It used to, you get in the gang, you grew up, you got married, got a job. But again, the social and economic kind of status of the U.S. has changed, and that's changed the role of gangs.
As gangs expand, and Carolina, by the way, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
As gangs expand and even go international, is gang membership becoming a career?
We're starting to see that people are staying in the gang longer, and part of at least my explanation is this issue that the other caller raised up, which is you have gang members that are getting locked up. So if we look again at the war on drugs in the 80s, people coming out of with minor drug offenses into an economy where ex-felons are not necessarily welcome, and so if you have nothing else to do, the gang is there, and it's in some ways, the only social support that you have if you can't be connected to the economy or other social institutions in a very meaningful way. Mm-hmm. So people are definitely staying in longer. And you see women getting involved in increasing rates, which is also something that's new and at least increasing the past 20 years or so.
To get a better idea of the international scope of this problem, joining us now is Alberto Concha Eastman, an advisor on violence at the Pan American Health Organization. That's a regional office of the World Health Organization. He's a panel member at today's conference here in Washington on Central American youth gang violence. Thanks very much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me to your program.
What differences have you seen lately in gang activity and its culture in Central America?
Actually, the problem has been growing up in the last, let's say, 10 years, in just not only in numbers of people involved, but also in the quality of the acts they portray. For example, there are some examples of brutal cases in Central America, gang activities. But that's an important change from the behavior the gangs are doing. However, there are also changes in the government, which, for example, in Salvador and Honduras, have taken a very hard step forward in terms of repression, mm-hmm. the gangs activities.
Are using, according to some critics anyway, the same tactics that they used against leftist guerrillas 25 years ago.
Yeah, actually a bit different, because the situation with these gangs is different. For example, if you have a tattoo, that supposes you are a gang member, and because you got a tattoo and you're a gang member, you go to jail without any charge, without proving that you have killed somebody, you have or nothing.
Let me just clarify that. You said in some places, if you have a tattoo, that is enough to send you to jail.
Yeah. That was the case last year, and they took thousands of boys and girls to jail, and some months later, they had to release them because there was no charge. But initially, they were put in jail for that particular reason. Hmm. Exactly for that, because you got a tattoo that said that you belong to this or that gun. For example, MS means Salvatrucha, and the other one, N18, means 18th Street, name of the gang. So that's the problem. That was the attitude that the governments took in these countries.
Are these members, are they modeling themselves on American gangster culture, or are they actual members of these gangs?
Right, actually, initially, when the problem started about 20, 25 years ago, to grow, because the gangs of pandillas, as they call them, have been existing for many years, but not in the numbers and the quality of the act they behave. But the problem started when some gang members who were in prison in the United States were deported to these countries. And when they arrived to their countries, they have nothing to do. They have no friends, and people were watching them with cautiously. So they decided to initiate their own gang down there. Mm-hmm. And later on, the situation changed with their own culture and norms within the country they live in. So initially, yes, there was some kind of relationship for the formation of the gangs. However, still that relationship exists. It has not been broken in full, but it still exists.
And some Central American political leaders say gangs are their equivalent to terrorists.
No, that's something we reject completely. That's something has not proven at all. Even some declarations from some officials in this country have said, no, there is no relationship between terrorists, Al-Qaeda, and these gangs activities in this country. They have no political reasons. They have no particular demands. There are people who gather in the streets that commit violent acts, but they have no relationship at all with terrorism. Hmm.
Alberto Concha Eastman, thank you very much. We'll let you get back to the conference.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Alberto Concha Eastman is a regional advisor on violence at the Pan American Health Organization and joined us from a conference he's attending here in Washington, D.C. on Central American youth gang violence. And Andrew Papakristos, I wanted to bring you in on this point and do so by reading you an email we got from Jill Hopke in Madison, Wisconsin. I spent 6 months living in El Salvador, she wrote, and wanted to ask your guest to talk about the problems that the 1996 changes in U.S. immigration policy have impacted the social fabric of Central American countries. For example, she says, in the case of El Salvador, the government has passed a series of laws called mano duro, or iron fist, that have been used to target youth even if they have no gang ties and infringe on civil liberties.
Well, I think there's two important things to kind of recall there. First of all, Central America and Latin America didn't need, they already had the existence of kind of armed young men running around and a history of violence in their mm-hmm. political and civic history. Now, the change in the 1996 immigration law essentially made it possible for the U.S. government to forcefully deport, if necessary, legal aliens who kind of ran afoul of the law. And in most cases, when you look at kind of the court cases, they're not recent illegal immigrants. These are legal immigrants who have been in the States for most of their lives, and since they were children, and then they get in trouble when they're, in their teens and early 20s and then get deported. Now, it's also kind of, since you realize that these are not drug kingpins necessarily or murderers that are being sent back, but people that are getting picked up for grand theft auto, minor drug offenses. So we're sending everybody in some respects back, where if they were, full citizens, they'd be on probation or parole. Now, as our other guest just pointed out, this is exacerbating things. It's bringing culture. It's also possibly making connections back and forth between the sending and receiving kind of countries. A lot of these folks don't want to go back to El Salvador or Honduras. As you also point out, it's illegal to be a gang member there, which means you're going to be locked up for 3 to 5 years simply for being a gang member. And how do you identify gang members, which is through tattoos? And there have been recent cases in Honduras where you have well-documented extrajudicial murders of gang members in prisons and the streets. It kind of you have roving groups of, we don't call them gangs, but whatever they are, going out and actually killing these young men right when they step off the plane. So U.S. immigration policy is inadvertently, turning petty criminals who've been here their whole lives, they're sending them to in some ways, a death sentence in El Salvador and these other kind of receiving countries.
We're talking with Andrew Papachristos about Gangsters Without Borders. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. An email question from Michael Tapia in San Antonio. Is there any evidence of true gang migration to various regions rather than copycat organizations?
Well, first of all, I conducted a big study of the Vicelord gangs in the Chicago region. You see migration. Migration, however, tends to be, again, very local. You see Vicelords going to other places in the Midwest, kind of going to the suburbs, going to other parts of Illinois, Indianapolis, Michigan. A lot of that is happening is not necessarily calculated moves by the gangs, although there are, rare examples of those. But what you see are gang members moving for jobs, for family reasons, and kind of basically setting up shop in their new town. Now, they're not necessarily connected with the gangs in Chicago or Los Angeles per se, although, of course, we've seen an example of the MS-13 that Detective Smith pointed out. But, most of this migration that's happening is happening because families are moving, as opposed to kind of gangs. Although, again, it does happen, but it happens usually within a close radius.
Another email question, this from Sean in Santa Cruz, California. I'm curious about the rhetorical connotation of the word gangs. What is a gang? How does a gang differ from more organized crime or average drug dealers?
See, now, if I could answer that question, I'd have my dissertation finished already.
Going for your PhD there, yeah.
But the way the public generally perceives it is gangs, as opposed to, say, other criminal organizations, tend to be specifically organized towards deviance or some kind of criminal activity. They tend to have a deeper sense of tradition, so a lot of the kind of standard adolescent groups, they don't last other than that groups. But where you see groups like, just say, the MS-13, they exist as members leave, right? So that group is a group that persists over time. It carries on a tradition. It carries on a certain heritage, a culture. So there's some kind of group process there that persists over time and over space, which really differentiates, say, the kind of average group of kids hanging out with each other to a gang. And the second being this criminal activity, but that, again, becomes a little bit problem because you want to know what types of crime, and that again, is relative. In Chicago, if somebody does a shoplifting gang, probably would be laughed at, whereas that might be a serious problem in other kind of locations.
Well, in your article, and I'm afraid we're just giving you 30 seconds for this, but you wrote, one of the most urgent challenges for policymakers is to distinguish between the average street gang and groups that operate as criminal networks. Is that what you were just talking about?
That's right. I mean, the MS-13, the Disciples, the Crips, the Bloods, these gangs are, they look like organized crime these days in some respects. But more so, they look like organized crime for about a dozen or so leaders, not the average member on the street. And so what law enforcement does, at least my experience with law enforcement, is they do target these kind of the leadership structures, the really bad apples in the gang. But it's important that when we're talking about policy that we don't craft policy, you know, equating gangs with terrorists, because most gangs don't have that organizational structure to collect dues or hold meetings, let alone operate these kind of transnational organizations. So it's really crucial that we differentiate between, you know, a bunch of guys hang out in the corner to people that have the capacity to organize these types of international activities.
Andrew Papachristos, thanks very much, and good luck with the dissertation.
Thank you.
Andrew Papachristos does research on gangs at the University of Chicago. His article, Gang World, in the current issue of Foreign Policy magazine. When we come back from a short break, Supreme Court rules on racial segregation in California prisons. This is NPR News.